All right.
Welcome to Robotics Seminar. Today we are very happy to have Fernando de la Torre Frade.
Very well pronunciation. Very well pronunciation.
Who has been a great shining light at the Robotics Institute for a number of years now, 3 years?
Three years.
In the computer, working in computer vision. And he has done a lot beforehand. He was he graduated from the La Salle School of Engineering in Barcelona, and then he was there for a few years, being a assistant professor, associate professor at a department, and then he decided that he wanted to see the world, and so he came to Pittsburgh.
Of course.
And he has been working on many various things, not just theoretical computer vision things, but actually things that are very much applied and that actually
useful.
Yeah, actually.
Do you want to give a talk? Maybe you know better than me.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. And but he is one of the top experts in the field of the generalized component analysis stuff. So we are, I guess, we're going to see mostly the theoretical side of Fernando, but there is, of course, a vast practical side as well. And he has given many tutorials at all the top conferences and held organized a couple of workshops. And so, for example, this year he has two CUPR papers. I think not even Takeo can claim more, I think.
Of course.
And so we're all very jealous.
They can claim more than two, not two, but more than two for sure.
Well, no, but in this CUPR. In any case, very happy to have Fernando, and here he is.
Thanks very much for the very kind and exaggerated introduction. It's always a pleasure to give a talk in front of this very familiar and distinguished audience. Today I'm going to talk about the work I've been doing over the last 2 years in a set of techniques which are called component analysis. What are these component analysis techniques? Component analysis are a set of almost algebraic techniques that, given a signal, factorize, decompose the signal into interesting components. And these interesting components define explicitly or implicitly, like in the kernel methods, the representation of the signal. And choosing the right representation of the signal is one of the key aspects to make any modeling, classification, or clustering algorithm to be successful. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. A methodology, a unifying framework to learn the representation of the signal that can be useful for modeling, classification, or clustering. I'm going to start motivating some of the problems in the context of a recent computer vision project for depression studies. Then the main block of the talk will be talking about how we can learn the representation of a signal for modeling, classification, or clustering. And I will finish with the conclusions and future work. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, 10% of the American population suffers from depression in a given year. Depression ranks, is one of the disorders that ranks in the top in terms of cost to society and personal cost. And current standards for diagnosis and evaluation of therapeutic effectiveness of depression are based in subjective clinical ratings, like the Hamilton score. If someone is depressed and goes to a clinician for an interview, at the end of the interview, the clinician has to rank the depressed state of the patient. So what he does, he has to answer several questions like this one, depressed mood. And the clinician has to rank between 0 and 4 the depressed mood of the patient. And he does so based on what the people of the patient reports and based on his expertise. And this is a big source of subjectivity. So one of the things, or the long-term, one of the long-term goals of this project is to see if we can provide some behavioral or physiological measures which can help us to diagnose and monitor depression. And today I'm just going to talk about a small part of this project, which is going to be to try to correlate facial behavior with this Hamilton score. From the facial behavior that you see in video, can you predict something about the depressed mood of the patient? So in order to do that, and in collaboration with UPMC, we are recording several interviews between the clinician and the patient. We have one camera focused in the face of the clinician, one camera focused in the body of the patient, and two cameras focused in the face of the patient. So the first thing, in order to correlate facial behavior with Hamilton score, is how we are going to describe facial behavior. One promising way to describing facial behavior has been the facial action coding system proposed by Ekman in the 70s. In this facial action coding system, the appearance of the face is described in terms of action units. Each of the action units is related to one or more facial muscles. For instance, action unit 2 is outer brow raiser. Action unit 9 is nose wrinkle. Action unit 5 is upper lip raiser. So what we want to do is automatically recover all these action units and action units combinations from video and correlate this information with the Hamilton score. There are about 43 action units and about 5,000 action units combinations. In order to do this automatically, we have to solve three problems, and this is what I'm going to talk about today. First, we have to track the facial features of the subject. Second, we have to classify the action units. And there are around, as I said before, 43 action units and 5,000 action units combination. And some of them are very subtle, so we have to do a really good job from the computer vision and machine learning perspective. And one of the bottlenecks of the action unit classification is to gather label data. In order to recognize or to gather label data for action unit 2, a common procedure is a certified fax coder goes to the video and frame by frame looks at each frame and tries to assign or to see all the action units and action units combinations that are happening in this frame. And this is very, yes.
So action unit is part of a face, so there could be several units in the same.
Oh, yes, yes. So we have action units for the brows, for the eyes, for the mouth, for the nose. Some people even can move the ears. So, you know, there are all sort of action, not me. But there are all sort of action units combination. And that one makes the problem a little bit hard. It's a model. So what I was saying, there is current methods are not efficient and reliable to manually go frame by frame and label all the action units and action units combination. So what we want to do is to do a more efficient process. How we are going to do that? What we would like to do is to group all these action units that occur in different time instances but are the same. So we want to cluster all the action units that happen in different time instances but are the same. So the fax coder has to label just once. And this is a clustering problem. So we have these three problems: tracking, classification, and clustering. And there are standard ways to solve these problems. For tracking, we have a set of methods that I'm going to talk now, which are active appearance models. For classification, we have some of the state-of-the-art techniques are based in support vector machine. And for clustering, there are a set of techniques which are very convenient, which are called spectrograph methods. Why? I don't use these techniques, and that's it. End of the talk. Because the key to make, one of the keys to make any of these techniques to work is what do we input to these techniques. For active appearance model, what do I input? Do I input edges? Do I input a filter image? Do I input the gray level? One of the things that make powerful to support vector machine is the idea of kernel. I take my data, I map it to a higher dimensional space, and in this space my data is linearly separable. But how do I know the mapping? In spectrograph methods, the same. The key aspect to make spectrograph methods work is to define the similarity between two samples. And even more, is to equilibrate the affinity matrix. So in order to make all these techniques to work successful, I have to learn, or I have to input, a good representation of the sigma. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, about a methodology to learn the representation of the sigma, which can be useful for tracking or modeling, classification, or clustering. And for that, I'm going to use a set of techniques that are called component analysis. As I said before, component analysis, given the signal, factorize the signal into interesting components. One of the first component analysis techniques has been the singular value decomposition or principal component analysis. And I'm going to briefly explain this one because this is very important for the rest of the talk. So let's say that I want to construct a model of the appearance variation of the human face. And I take many faces of different people. And I create a data matrix D. This matrix is going to be with us until the end of the talk. It's D of data. So and then what I do is I vectorize each of these gray level images into a vector. And I have a data matrix with n columns and d rows, number of pixels or features. So what component analysis tries to do is any of these faces is going to be expressed as a linear combination of some orthogonal bases. And principal component analysis finds these orthogonal bases. How does principal component analysis find these orthogonal bases? Well, it computes the eigenvectors of this covariance matrix. My matrix is D, the transpose is the covariance. And the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix are this direction of the signals that possess maximum variation. And maximum variation is one criteria and can be interesting for clustering, but maybe not for classification or tracking. But that's what principal component analysis does. If you have an image of 2 pixels, what principal component analysis is doing is decorrelating the data. And for instance, the first component is aligned with these directions of maximum variation of the signal. And principal component analysis is just about preserving energy. And the information maybe is not in energy preservation criteria. And there are many other techniques. For instance, I can have 2 data sets, and I want to find the directions of maximum discrimination among these data sets. You can use linear discriminant analysis. Or if you want to find the direction of maximum correlation, you can use canonical correlation analysis. Sometimes you would like to put some kind of sparseness in these bases, and you have independent component analysis or non-negative matrix factorization. And this is just to mention some of them. Why do I think component analysis are a set of techniques that are useful to solve visual learning problems? I think they are especially useful in the context of computer vision. Why? Because in computer vision, usually we have to learn from very high dimensional data, and we have very few training samples. For instance, my face can be represented in an image of 100 by 100 pixels. And this can be represented as a vector in a 10,000 dimensional space. And usually I have several hundreds of faces to learn from. So I want to learn in almost empty spaces. And that's a problem. So what component analysis do is they take this data, project it into a lower dimensional space, and the number of parameters that I have to estimate is much lower. Also, it's a very versatile technology. As I will show later, it's relatively easy to incorporate robustness to noise, missing data or layers, to make try to learn some features invariant to geometric transformations. That's a very important feature for computer vision problems. And we can extend these component analysis techniques to learn nonlinear representations of the data. Before, principal component analysis was finding just correlation, which is not very interesting. But we can extend with kernel methods to learn nonlinear representations. Or maybe you like to define a probability density model over the parameters. No problem. We can have probabilistic interpretations of component analysis technique, which is called latent variable model. Or sometimes I would like to have a multifactorial model. For instance, if you see my face, the appearance of my face variation changes due to the lighting, to do the expression, and to the pose. So I would like to have a model that is able to independently model pose changes, expression changes, and illumination changes. And this can be done with tensors. And even more important, the methods I'm going to explain later, the computational cost of this method scales linearly with respect to features, and that's important. We don't want anything more than linear when we work with images, because these are pixels. And between linearly and quadratic with the number of samples. So it's just me, the only one who cares about these component analysis methods, or the rest of the scientific community thinks that these methods are useful and valid. In order to ask these questions, what I did is I took the proceedings from a major computer vision conference, which is called CBPR, and I count how many papers, at some point or another, make use of component analysis methods. Actually, 20% of these papers. 1 out of 5 papers make use in 2006 of this component analysis. So it's a set of technology which is used nowadays. Then I also Googled the most common techniques in component analysis, and the number of hits was pretty high. Is component analysis the most popular item on the web? No. people care about Britney Spears more than component analysis. But that's before I start publishing Spears component analysis. Then we'll see. Okay, so let's start with the tracking modeling problem. What do I want? I want to get some results like this. If I give you a video, I want to be able to track the facial features of this person with this accuracy. It's a very good tracking. And this is done with active appearance model, a technique that I'm going to talk a little bit later. So what's the problem? I already have the results. The problem is, in order to get this accurate tracking, we had to get person-specific models. We build a model which is adapted to the facial features of this person. And this required to label 10% of these frames, which is a lot of time that you spend labeling to construct a person-specific model. So what we would like to do is to build generic models. I want to build a model of face that can track any of your facial features. That's the goal. So in order to understand the problem, let's try to understand how these active appearance models work. What I want to do is to build a model of the shape and appearance variation of the human face. What I do is I hire an army of undergrads who are cheaper than graduate students, and they start labeling 68 points in many faces. And then what I do is I construct a model of the shape variation and appearance variation. How do I construct this model? I take all the shapes, I align the shapes, and then I do this principal component analysis. This gives me an orthogonal base for the shapes. Such a linear combination of these shape bases is going to reconstruct the identity and the expression of each of these people, if the model generalizes well. But I also construct a model of the appearance variation. I take the grade level information from within each of these landmarks, I build this appearance representation, I do the same principal component analysis, and I have a linear basis, a linear combination of these bases is going to reconstruct the appearance of each of these subjects. Yes?
So what I always wondered is, you could also just keep the original images as exemplars and have those as your bases and do a linear combination of basically all your
yes.
labeled examples.
Yeah.
What is PCA buying you so of course it's a compression is one, but
uh-huh.
is it also buying you anything else in addition to compression?
It's buying you two things or three things. The first thing, as you say, is compression. So let's say that I have 2,000 images, and then I put my face as linear combination of these 2,000 images. The first thing that is going to happen is I have too much expressibility in the model. A linear combination of 2,000 images can reconstruct probably this bottle. So what we want is a model which is specific enough. And I want to remove irrelevant information for tracking. And this is something not all the texture that I have in my face is going to be relevant to tracking. Probably the most important or interesting parts are going to be eyes and mouth. And that's something that principal component analysis is doing, is taking these directions of maximum variation and removing the noise. So there is the part of deficiency, because if now, as I'm going to talk now, what we want to do is fit a new image to this model. If I have a very big model, it's going to be very computationally costly. So there is the efficiency, and there is the aspect of removing irrelevant dimensions for tracking. In this case, I'm not claiming, and that will be one of the main points, that principal component analysis is the optimal representation of the signal for tracking, as you will see later. So what's the problem now? Given a new image, I have to fit this model to a new image. How do I fit this model? Which are the model parameters that I want to learn? Remember, I have a shape basis. A linear combination of these shape bases can reconstruct any shape of the human face. So what I have is, I have this shape, and to this shape, I'm going to allow to rotate, translate, and scale with a set of rigid parameters. Each of these shapes, mode shapes, I'm going to allow to rotate, translate, and scale. And then I'm going to linearly combine all these shapes. And I'm going to get one instance of this model, of the shape model. Now I'm going to take the grade level inside this shape model, and I'm going to compute the reconstruction error with respect to the appearance subspace. I take the shape, I rotate, translate, and scale the shapes, I linearly combine, give half an instance of a new shape, and then I project the gray level information to this appearance space. If the facial features are located in a bad place and the model does not generalize very well, then I have a very high error. However, if the facial features are located in the good place and the model generalizes well, I'm going to have a lower error. So I'm putting here the tracking as an optimization problem. Given a new image, what I have to infer is, tell me which is the rotation translation scale, non-rigid parameters, and appearance parameters that better fit this image. And it's a very complex and high dimensional optimization problem.
Is this 2D or
3D? This is 2D. If we have 3D, we have even more ambiguities. And then we try. I took 200 faces, human faces, for learning, and I applied to unseen faces. And that's the kind of result that I got. Doesn't seem to work too well. So here we can see that we cannot track facial expressions like this. So the algorithm is not doing a very good job with the PCA representation. So just to give you a more quantitative idea, this is the histogram of the error. What I do is, with a face detector, I locate the face of all the users. I initialize the algorithm to a mean shape, with a mean shape. I let the algorithm converge, and I compute the error, the difference between the convergence of the algorithm and the ground truth. And I get this kind of histogram of the error over 1,000 images. None of these 1,000 images have been in the training set. And the average error is pretty high. It's around 7.5 pixels, so it's pretty high. Okay, so this doesn't work. And the question is why? Maybe I don't have enough training data. Maybe. Maybe I have outliers and my data is very noisy, and this outlier bias my solution, and I cannot generalize well. Maybe. Maybe I'm optimizing the wrong error function. Maybe. Maybe it's a very hard problem and has many local minima. Maybe. Maybe the space of human face is not linear, and I'm trying to model with a linear model. Maybe. Or maybe the space of human faces is linear, but in another space. Maybe. Or maybe it's all of them. Maybe. I'm not going to have time to answer all these maybes. But I'm going to give you a couple of ideas that shows the methodology that I want to convey. The first thing is, let's try to understand a much simpler problem. The simpler problem is, I'm going to try to detect the face of this user. And let's say that I know the exact template that I want to look for. And I do some kind of normalized correlation, and this is the kind of error function that I have. Perfect. That's the kind of error function I want. It has just one global minima in the right place. However, when I get a bunch of training samples where the face of the user is not in these training samples, I do the PCA, and I do the same two undesirable things happen. First, I don't have a local minima in the right place, and I have more than one local minima. So this is telling me that the PCA is not generalizing well. So how can I solve this problem? How can I learn a representation which has better generalization properties? And this is going to be one of the key ideas of the talk. If you want to do something interesting, forget about closed form solution. Forget about the fact that PCA is taking vectors of a covariance matrix, and then relate the problem to an error function. Principal component analysis minimize this error function. Where this supply is the set of training samples I want to learn from, B is a particular axis of this subspace which expands maximum variation of my signal, and I have to optimize with respect to B. And C is a linear, is the coefficient, such a linear combination of these bases is going to reconstruct each of these samples. If you put this in matrix form, this is just a bilinear factorization of the data. And this is going to be a very important equation. This is the fundamental equation of component analysis. What I'm going to show in this talk is all what I'm going to do is take this equation and apply for tracking, classification, and clustering problem with different properties. But this is going to be the generative equation of all the talk, this one. And at the end, you will see the unification of all these methods. Okay, sure, now I relate my problem to an error function. What kind of interesting things can I do? For instance, let's say what we really want is to avoid local minima problems. Why could we don't design a representation that explicitly avoid local minima problems. What I want is if the face of the user is in the right place, I want an error function that returns the minimum value. And if I have my face shifted around, what I want is that the error function returns a higher value. That's what I want. That's the kind of representation that I want to learn that avoids local minima. Can I do something? Yes, you can, because you have related the problem to an error function. What we are going to do is to minimize this error function. This is the PCA error that I showed before, and this is the x and y position. When I have the face in the right position, I want this error returns a very low value. This function is this function g. I'm mapping the error to this kind of Gaussian function, which is exactly what I want. Can I learn a set of bases and coefficients that after I shift around this image has some kind of error function like this? Can I do that? Yes, you can do it, but doesn't work. Why doesn't work? Why doesn't work? It doesn't work because I'm spending a lot of the expressivity of this model in trying to accurately model this function, which there is no reason for. But seems a good idea. And we have some other, this is just for translation, but obviously we have some other generalization for rotation, translation, and scale. But this is just to illustrate the methodology that we can do by relating the problems to an error function. And now I'm going to show something that works. So I played with many things, and nothing seemed to have too much impact. So what I got some inspiration is from the multiband representation that people in texture classification, and we need to have Aloshi over here, I don't know, if not I forgot. But in texture classification and face recognition, they use this multiband representation to represent the signal. What's this multiband representation? What they do is they take an image, and they convolve this image with filters at different scales and orientation, and then concatenate all the representation. And I'm going to show that this is a very good representation for our problem, for this active appearance model tracking. What I'm going to show is in the same problem that we have before, we are going to take the training data. I'm going to filter this training data with a bank of filters. I'm going to concatenate all the response from all these filters, and I'm going to show two things. I'm going to convolve, and I'm going to show that we are going to have the minimum more often in the right place, and that the distance from the optimal minimum to the second closest minimum is going to be higher. So I have better generalization properties. That's what I'm going to show. And the main contribution of this talk, of this part of the talk, is that we are going to learn the filter. Usually people, other scientists, have used a set of filters like Gabor filters or oriented pair filters or Gaussians and derivative of Gaussian. But these filters are not adapted to the object that you want to track. So I'm going to learn a set of filters that are adapted to the two-dimensional statistics of faces. So, okay, that sounds good, but how do you learn these filters? What I'm going to do is I want to learn a set of filters that when I convolve the images, the faces, with these filters, I preserve maximum energy. So I take my data, I convolve this data with a filter, and I want maximum response from this set of filters to the faces, but I want minimum response to the background. So I want a set of filters, a bank of filters, that have maximum response to the faces, but minimum response to the background. And I impose some constraints in the filters, just that they are orthogonal, so they don't span the same space, and the norm is unitarian. So does it have any relation with the formula that you show us before? This principal component analysis actually is the same. It's the same with just one difference. Here in principal component analysis, you take the data, project the data into a low-dimensional space, and you do a dot product. Here I'm doing a convolution. That's the only difference. I change dot products by convolutions. And this has closed form solution and nice properties. Okay, let's see. Does it work? We did the following experiment. So we took 100 images, and we learned a model from 100 images. And then we took another 120 images, which are not in the training set. We put it into different backgrounds. And obviously, we know the expected location of this face. If we take these images and just try to locate these new faces with grade level information, just grade level representation, we get 41% of accuracy in the location. With this filter component analysis, 74. And with the best of the Gabor filters, 62. The second thing that we did is we compute the distance between this expected local minima and the second closest local minima. Filter component analysis has higher distance, so it has better generalization properties. The third thing is that we account how many local minima do we have. The average number of local minima is again lower in this filter component analysis. So we have learned something about the signal, which is giving us better generalization properties. Alosha.
So what's the first column? You're just taking one, the best Gabor filter of all?
No, what I'm taking is the Gabor filter has are designed at different scales and orientations. Okay. So what I take is, from all the possible scales that I can come up with, give me the best scale.
And then you just apply normal PCA to that?
Normal PCA to it,
okay.
Yeah.
And in FCA, you're using all of them together?
In both of them, I use four filters.
Oh, I see.
In both of them, four filters. But this, the results from Gabor are, among all the possible subset of four filters that I can have at different scales, pick up the best.
I see. Okay.
Because I don't know the scale, of the optimal scale of my sigma.
Okay. But in FCA, I thought you were...
In FCA, you learn that.
You learn that.
You say, okay, you know, I give you the filter, try to learn what's the best filter that is going to capture this spatial distribution of filters, of the signal, of phases. Okay, yeah, this seems to work. And now what happened with our original problem, which is active appearance model tracking? Here is, again, the distribution of the error for filter component analysis and principal component analysis. So what we can see is the average error has been reduced from 7.5 to 5 pixels. How does it translate into images? So these are some videos that shows when we have a completely generic model. These people are obviously not in the training set. And we can see how filter component analysis is doing a better job trying to fit the facial features of these people. And here what we do is we initialize the active appearance model with the solution, the convergence of the previous person. And you can see how the algorithm is generic and adapt to different expressions and facial features. And also what we try to do is we try to apply this to the robotics faculty because, believe it or not, they are also humans. And sure enough, it seems to work very reasonable. Alosha, as always, gives us some trouble. His head is usually 2.5 standard deviation farther from the mean head. But even with math, works pretty well. Does it work?
That's the important thing.
It's an important thing. You are an outlier in terms of shape of the head. Which means you have a lot of neurons inside. But does it work for everybody? No. There are some hard cases. Chris is so unique that good luck to generic models. I'm going to leave him for future research. Okay. Also, we compare the results with one of the state-of-the-art trackers, which is called Bayesian tangent shape models, and our results are at least marginally better. For instance, this is just one picture of Takeo. And one of the problems with Bayesian approaches is they try to bias the shape towards the mean shape. But filter component analysis could return the smile to Takeo, which is always a good thing. Okay, so this has been tracking. Now I'm going to talk about classification. What's the problem with classification? Okay, so I took what I want to do is classify action units. So what I took is many action unit 25 from many different people, or action unit 17, as again from many different people, and project into the first three principal components. And I see one thing, that I have multimodality here. If you rotate this, I cannot fit an hyperplane that I can separate these two classes. So what standard approaches do to solve this problem? One of the state-of-the-art techniques to solve classification problems is called super vector machine. What are the advantages of this super vector machine? There are two. First, we maximize the concept of margin, and this is done in a very nice job with quadratic programming techniques that don't have local minima. But second is the concept of kernel. Let's say that I want to separate these two classes. In this space, if I try to fit an hyperplane, well, there is no hyperplane, no line that I can fit here that separate these two classes. So what kernel methods do, they take this data, map it to a higher dimensional space, in this case just a quadratic mapping is enough, and try to fit an hyperplane in this high dimensional space. But the key is, well, sure, but how do you know the mapping? How do you know the mapping? That's the art of super vector machines. And that's what I'm going to talk now about, how can we learn this mapping to make data, hopefully, linearly separable. And I'm going to illustrate this concept with this toy problem. Here I have two classes. It's the classical XOR problem. I have two classes, class 1 in blue and class 2 in red. And I want to learn a kernel. The kernel defines an implicit representation of my signal that does two things. First, take this data and remove irrelevant dimensions for classification. What I want is both classes share this theta axis. So I want a method that removes this irrelevant dimension for classification because it's not relevant for classification. That is the thing that I want. Second, I want a method that takes this data from this space and map it to another space such that my data is linearly separable. I'm asking these two things to the kernel. I want to take this data and remove irrelevant dimensions for classification, and take this data and map it to another space where data becomes linearly separable. That's what I want. Okay, I want that, but how do I get it? So just to mention that there are, obviously I'm not the first one in solving such a problem. There is a lot of literature in neural networks. For instance, neural networks, by adding hidden units, were able to solve these problems. There is work in metric learning and kernel metric. Why this work is different from previous work? There are three aspects that make it different. First, I'm going to learn a functional mapping of my data. The previous work didn't do it. Second, I combine kernel with dimensionality reduction. And the third thing is the computational cost of the algorithm is going to scale linearly in the number of features, pixels, and quadratically in the number of samples. The previous approach used semi-definite programming techniques that are much more expensive than this. Okay, so sure, I want to learn this mapping. How do I learn this mapping? The key idea is I'm going to parameterize this kernel matrix. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put this kernel matrix as a positive combination of many kernel matrices power t. It's like a Taylor expansion of kernel matrices. Each of these kernel items, each of the elements of this kernel matrix, is going to define the notion of similarity between two samples. And again, it's going to be a positive combination of this matrix, of this element M, that I'm going to talk about it now, power T, like a Taylor series expansion. This element M is going to define, is a notion of similarity, is going to define a notion of similarity between two samples. In this case, the cosine distance. So I take a data sample I, an image I take a data sample J, and then I do the dot product between these two. And I normalize this dot product. That's the cosine distance. But what I want to do is to remove irrelevant dimensions. Not all the pixels are going to be treated equally. That's what I want. So what I do is I introduce this matrix, metrics matrix AT. Just to, this metric matrix AT is going to select these directions which are relevant for classification. One of the key aspects is to make this matrix AT, or the nice mathematical aspect, is to make it positive semi-definite. If this matrix IT is positive, semi-definite, I can guarantee that the result is going to be a kernel. If not, I cannot. But this is a hard thing, and that's where most of these semi-definite programming approaches come into play. So what we did instead is we parameterized the space of positive semi-definite matrices as the outer product of this matrix BB transpose plus some lambda identity. This lambda has to be positive. But just to make the story short, the idea is that we parameterize this kernel with several parameters. These Bs that are going to give me the directions of maximum discrimination between the signal, these lambdas, which act as a regularization parameters, and these positive coefficients alpha. okay, sure, I have this parametrization, but how do I learn these parameters? The thing that I'm going to do is, I'm going to take this parameterized kernel, and I'm going to try to map it to an ideal kernel. What is an ideal kernel? Let's say that I have this problem. An ideal kernel is a matrix like this. If I have two samples that belong to the same class, I want a similarity of one. If I have two samples that belong to different classes, I want a similarity of zero. So I'm trying to map these parametrized kernels to this ideal ideal kernel. Also, I have to add some weights always to make things work. So these weights are, if two samples are in the input space, in the original space, close to each other, I put high weights. And if they are far away and belong, obviously, to the same class, I put lower weights. This avoids some overfitting. These weights can take into account outliers and missing data, and can take into account situations, practical situations that always occur, of unbalanced data. In some classes, I have 20 samples, and the others, 500. So how do you compensate with that? With weights. OK. And just a brief remark, and this becomes part of the unification. If I take this Taylor series expansion, and I pick up just the first term of this Taylor series expansion, I have a formula like this, which is exactly the same as linear discriminant analysis. So what I'm talking to you guys is just a nonlinear consistent extension of linear discriminant analysis. OK. So let's say that we optimize everything. What kind of results did you get in these experiments? Two interesting things happen here. First, if I have a look to this matrix A, I see that one of the eigenvalues is zero. The eigenvector associated with this eigenvalue zero has this direction. So the matrix A, it really, is removing these directions which are irrelevant for classification. Even more interesting. And now I take the data. I remove irrelevant dimension for classification. I take the data. I project it to a low-dimensional space. Now, let's measure cosine distances between the samples in this low-dimensional space. If I have two samples that belong to different class but the same class, the cosine is going to be minus 1. If I have two samples that belong to the same class and cluster, the similarity is going to, the cosine is going to be approximately 1. And if I have two samples that belong to the same to different classes, the similarity is going to be approximately 0. So what do I have to do to convert this this kernel matrix to an ideal kernel matrix? Well, the only thing I have to do is to take these negative numbers and power them to an even power. And that's what the algorithm is discovering. Just these alphas, which are even, are the ones which are different from zero. So the algorithm really is discovering this mapping, this nonlinear mapping of my data. Okay, so this is a technique that improves classification because it learns the kernel. Unfortunately, we are not able to apply this to our original problem, which is action unit recognition, but we apply to the problem of pedestrian detection. This is some real data just to show you results. So what we have to solve here is, given an image, can you classify if there is a pedestrian, yes or not? So we took as a training 20,000 samples of 10,000 samples of pedestrian, 10,000 samples of non-pedestrian. We leave another 10,000 samples for cross-validation, and the other 20,000 samples from testing. And these are the kind of rock curves that we got. The blue is the one for linear support vector machine. The green is the one for radial basis function support vector machine. In these two techniques, we tune all the parameters with this cross-validation data, so it's as good as probably as you get. But with this kernel, learned kernel method, because it's a more flexible representation of my data, I was able to get better rock curves. Okay, so let's move to the third problem. Clustering. What do I want to do now? As I said before, one of the problems is I want to do more efficient and reliable fax coding. So in order to do that, I have to group together all the action units that are the same. Let's say that at time 25, I have the subject is doing an action unit 12. And at time 500, this subject is doing the same action unit 12, but I'm rotating a little bit my head. How can I do some grouping invariant to geometric transformations of my data? How can I define a similarity measure that says that in terms of shape and appearance, this mouth and this mouth are doing the same facial expression? How can I learn this grouping, this clustering, invariant to these geometric transformations of my data? And that's what I'm going to talk about now. So this is, I want to make sure that the similarity between these two points is the same, invariant to these geometric transformations. And this is a the classical clustering problem. Clustering problem, as all of you know, it's an NP-complete problem because the number of possible partitions of my data is pretty hard. But let's say, and there are many approximate algorithms, like the k-means. Let's say that I want to cluster these data samples. What k-means does is randomly initialize, and I want to cluster into three clusters. I randomly initialize three of the centers of these clusters. Then I assign the points to the cluster which is closer in Euclidean terms, and then I recompute the mean. And I iterate this process until convergence. That's the kind of thing that k-means does. The interesting thing is, well, sure, this is an algorithm, but is there an error function that minimizes this algorithm? Yes, there is. Interestingly enough, is this error function? Hey, wait a minute, Fernando, this is the error function that you showed us before. Yes, it is. So you are telling me that principal component analysis has anything to do with k-mean? Yes, I'm telling you that. So what is this error doing? Here I have my data matrix D, such that each of the columns is one vectorized image. I have my matrix B, such each of the columns is going to be the center of the clusters. And before, in principal component analysis, I had a bilinear factorization of the data. Before, this was a continuous variable. Now, this is a dummy indicator matrix. What this dummy indicator matrix is doing? For instance, it's a matrix such each of the columns has 1, 1, and the rest 0. And if I have the first column of this matrix Z transpose is 1, 0, 0, what it's doing is selecting this, this big one, this center, to correspond to the first sample. So I assign the first sample to the first center, centroid of my data. So this matrix is assigning which sample belongs to which cluster. So the only difference between this and principal component analysis is that in principal component analysis, this is continuous, and here I have a discrete matrix that satisfies these constraints. But because of that, the problem is NP-hard. Okay, so sure, k-means is a technique, but as we all know, it's efficient, but has many problems. Two of the main problems is it's very sensitive to local minima, and it depends how you initialize the algorithm, and it's just optimal for spherical clusters. I cannot cluster something like that. So, well, sure. But there are a set of techniques, which is called spectral graph clustering, that can address these problems. In spectral graph clustering, let's say that I want to cluster this group of points. What spectral graph clustering algorithms do? First, they create an affinity matrix. Each of the elements of this affinity matrix it contains the similarity between two points of this set of points. So here contains the similarity between these two points. Spectral graph methods take this affinity matrix, computes the eigenvectors, and find an embedding where the clustering is going to be easier. In this space, I don't know how to cluster things. K-means is never going to work. But if I find this embedding here, sure, things are going to work nicely. Now the question is there any relation between this k-means algorithm and this family of spectral graph algorithms? Actually, there is. And we just need to change two things. Now, we take the data, and we map it to a higher dimensional space with kernel methods, and weight differently the data, we have a family of spectral graph methods. And that's an important connection. And then I will go back at the end to emphasize a little bit more this connection. But now, Before, in spectral graph methods, we have an affinity matrix. And try to understand normalization factors here is very complicated because I don't know the genesis of this affinity matrix. I don't know where this affinity matrix comes from. But now I know. I know it comes from this minimization. So I can understand much better things, hopefully. Okay, so now you know there is this error function. But that was not my problem. My problem is I want to compute this clustering invariant to geometric transformations. How can I do it? Well, what we are going to do is to parameterize the data. So let's say that I have this sample. I'm going to allow this sample to rotate, translate, and scale. And I introduce a set of parameters, A, which are going to allow my data to rotate, translate, and scale. And what I'm going to have now is an error function which depends on the parameters A that I have to optimize, rotation, translation, and scale, and the parameter G, the matrix G that tells me which sample belongs to which cluster. I'm not going to go into how to optimize that, so you can be still alive, but I'm going to show you just some results. So what I'm going to show now is a video. This is the time axis. Each of the colors correspond to one cluster. And what I'm going to show is that the algorithm is able to find these clusters invariant to geometric transformations of data because the face of the user is moving around. And this is how the algorithm, we randomly initialize the algorithm. Each of the colors is one of the clusters. And the algorithm simultaneously clusters the data and registers the data with respect to the clusters. And we alternate these two steps until convergence. And at the end, the algorithm is able to find some clusters invariant to these geometric transformations of my data. Okay, so I'm going to show a video just where you can see here is a subject, and we are able to track with an active appearance models. And then each of the frames, we relate each of the frames to one of the clusters which is consistent in terms of appearance and shape, invariant to geometric transformations. And what I'm showing here is we are able to group a consecutive set of clusters that happen more than once into a set of facial gestures of mouth events. And we are also able to detect unusual expressions like this one. This is for a project that we have in deception detection. We want to detect if somebody lies or not from video. And detecting unusual microexpressions might help. So we'll see. I'm telling the truth here. I'm telling component analysis are the best. So, okay. So this is just an example. So now it's time to wake up because it's the end. And just two ideas from this talk. First, just to remark, representation is important. If we want to make any tracking, modeling, classification, or clustering algorithm to work and work well, we need to choose the representation. And component analysis is a methodology that is very versatile methodology that can be used to learn the representation of the data for tracking, classification, or clustering. Another important idea is the power of this component analysis comes from forgetting closed-form solutions and relating the problem to error functions. Because I can have a better understanding of the problem, like normalization factors. In the case of spectral graph methods, it's very hard to understand, you know, how I'm going to normalize the data. But if I know where this eigenvalue problem comes from, I can understand normalization factors. Second, it's an easy generalization. Once you have your error function, you can change metric, you can put invariance to geometric transformation, you can put regularization term, you can do many things. And the third thing is that there are many optimization techniques available. And this is probably the most important slide of the whole talk. I start with this bilinear factorization of data, this principal component analysis model. I have my data and I find a bilinear factorization of my data. Then I came up with the first technique, which you just take this data, change dot products by convolutions. You can learn a representation which has been proven to be useful for active appearance model tracking. Then you take this equation and just change two things, and you have a family of clustering algorithms. So this variable, rather than being continuous, you just make it discrete. And this matrix, you map it to a higher dimensional space with kernel methods. You have a family, K means spectral graph methods, just by changing two things. In classification, the same. You take this error, this fundamental equation of component analysis, and change two things. And you have linear discriminant analysis. Now you take this data, because it's a discriminative model, you project it into a low dimensional space and try to map it to an ideal kernel. You have linear discriminant analysis. If you make a Taylor series expansion, you have a non-linear generalization of linear discriminant analysis. And today I didn't have time to talk about, but I'm doing some other work in the area of visualization of transforming this matrix to the classical multidimensional scaling problem. The problem we are trying to solve is about indoor people localization. Let's say that I have a cell phone and I walk around one building at CMU. And when I'm close to a laptop or a desktop that they also have Bluetooth, I have a connectivity of one. If not, I have a connectivity of zero. And the question is, can I recover the trajectory of one or more subjects if I don't know the position of the laptop, desktop, and my position? So this problem can be solved with this multidimensional scaling type of techniques. And this multidimensional scaling comes also from here. And over the years, I've been doing several extensions that just take this fundamental equation and try to solve several problems in the context of computer vision. But just all this modeling, classification, clustering, or visualization comes from just, this is in preparation. Sorry, it's in preparation. We have high hopes from this ICCV. The deadline is in a, it's in a week, but eventually, well, we hope to get in. Future work. But the idea is, you just take this fundamental equation and you can map it to a variety of techniques. And that's where the unification comes from. Okay, so what's next? I'll show some progress in the original problem that we have for trying to correlate facial behavior with Hamilton score, but there is still a lot to do. First, I think we need more subtle machine learning and computer vision algorithms. So we need better trackers, and we are working in improving the generic model and the speed. Now our algorithm works at one frame per second, which is pretty bad. We still haven't applied the inverse composition algorithm from Simon and Baker and Matthews, and we plan to do it. And also, we have methods to track with changes in pose. I didn't have time to talk about, but that's what we are improving. In classification, one of the fundamental problems of classifiers are two problems. First, they are not robust to noise because they are not generative. So I don't know, or nobody knows, how to impose robustness to noise in discriminative models. And that's one of the things I'm working on. And in the clustering, the major problem that we have is we don't know how to automatically estimate the number of clusters. So right now we try many information, different information criteria, minimum descriptor length, Akaike information criteria, but doesn't seem to work too well. So we just manually tweak the algorithm. And we are in the process of validating the results for fax coding. I still think we need more efficient optimization schemes. What I show today scales linearly in the number of features, which is fine, but sometimes quadratically in the number of samples. That's too high. So we are addressing this problem. And we need other parametrization. With Stacy and Bernardo, I'm trying to incorporate all the differential equation literature into the problem of feature extraction. So we are working along this line. And also, if you have any clustering, classification, or visualization problem, come to talk to me, because component analysis can do it. And maybe we have 2 minutes or not. Yes, I'm going to show just this video, which probably it's going to be more interesting. So apart from behavior, I'm also interested in understanding how drugs affect behavior. So in collaboration with Dr. Bismayer at UPMC, what we are trying to do is continuously monitor kids with attention deficit disorder. These kids which are very impulsive, that they cannot focus and they are moving around. And they take a very strong drug, which is called Ritalin. But this drug doesn't affect to everybody the same. And one of the keys is what amount of dosage to give to this particular kid. So what we want to do is to monitor, and this is Carlos, which is around there. But what we want to do is to continuously monitor this kit. We have one camera, we have a speech, we have the program that the user is running, we have a GPS, and we have the body media sensor. This has an array of sensors like galvanic skin response, skin temperature, and other sensors. So the problem that the machine learning problem is how from this multimodal data you can infer activity. And we have some preliminary results along these lines. This, by the way, this video was originally motivated for one problem that I have every day, and probably many of you have, that every day you wake up with great expectations, you do a list of all the things you plan to do during the day. However, at the end of the day, half of this work has not been done. And then you think, well, what did I do today? So if you want to know what you did in one day, just come to talk to me, because I'm looking for volunteers to test this system. Also, with Dr. Houston, I'm working in trying to detect hot flashes in menopausic women. Currently, there are no physiological measures to detect hot flashes. So from galvanic skin response in the chest and the hair red, we are trying to put this as a detection classification problem. And just to say that all this work would not be done without some of the work, some of the students and visitors, which obviously helped me. And I just want to thank the collaborators that have contribute to the talk that I've been doing today, especially Jeff Cohn, which we had many long and interesting discussions about depression. Takeo, Simon, but with a lot of happiness about depression. And then Takeo, Simon, Ian, and another Simon, just for many interesting discussions, and the students who helped me, Alvaro, Joan, Manuel, and Uriol, who helped me with all the work that you have seen today. And I just want to thank all of you for mostly being awake. And I just want to make a brief announcement. I'm organizing the first workshop on component analysis for computer vision problems. The deadline is this Sunday, so if you want to spend an exciting weekend with component analysis, I will be very happy. CPPR. It's jointly with CPPR, yeah. It's going to be in Minneapolis. So, you know, I think that's about 1 hour. So I guess there is some time for questions, and thanks very much for your attendance.
All right, thank you for a wonderfully energetic talk. For Fernando.
The best pronunciation.
The number of points that you track is 60-something?
It's 68.
And how many muscles control those?
Oh, that's a very cool question. There are more muscles than points. The only thing that we try to do is we try to put these points in the muscles which are related to action units. In fact, one of the things we want to do is to do everything action unit related. We want to learn a set of filters which have anatomical basis. That's one of the things we want to do right now. But that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions?
Well, I have a question.
Of course.
You have all this whole slide of maybes, which I thought was a very cool slide.
Yeah. I don't have answer for all of them.
Well, do you have any kind of intuitions about what do you think, for example, is the face space linear or not? And in general, you know, what things are actually, you know, linear is just that the representation is wrong, and when eventually we'll find a representation which it will be linear, and which problems it's just hopeless and we need to do something nonlinear.
There are things which are definitely nonlinear. For instance, changes in pose. If you look at changes in pose, that's a nonlinearity.
So you can think that if you have the really, really clever filter that undoes that, then it will be linear because it will defend.
Probably between two views it's going to be linear. Between several views it's going to be hard to be linear. But in the case of faces, of just frontal faces, if you try to plot each of the pixels, so this pixel with respect to this pixel, among many people, it's not going to be linear. I don't think it's going to be linear because there are glasses, because there are people with beard. If you just take all the people without glasses, without beard, without any type of occlusion, with the same illumination condition, probably a linear model, I think, is going to fit. But that's one of the things we have to test, exactly. How do we know if things are linear or not? That's the first thing I always say, visualize the data. The problem is, how do you visualize very high dimensional data? You need to go to these dimensionality reduction techniques. Problem, these dimensionality reduction techniques make linear assumptions like principal component analysis. So it's kind of egg chicken problem. But still, from the principal component analysis, you can see the distribution. If you take the data and you project into the first three principal components, and the data is very nonlinear there, bad sign. This means that the data in this high dimensional space is likely to be also nonlinear. But that's a very good point. That's a very good point. And, you know, I always like linear methods because you can make them work. Nonlinearities are pretty hard.
Well, in a way, one mathematician told me that, in fact, all mathematics is linear methods. So, you know, calculus, for example, just trying to make things linear, right? You make linear approximations because that's the only thing we can do. Any other?
And this is the issue. Carlos?
Did you use color at all for doing all this tracking?
No. Everything grade level. But for instance, now this is just the theoretical part. Now we have to implement a real system. For the real system to detect the phase, color is the thing that works the best. So we will use color to detect the phase, so to improve or reduce false positive from the OpenCV phase detector. So in terms of making a real system, yes, we will use color. Tracking in the RGB space is going to be better than tracking in the gray level space. I'm not so sure about that, in the sense that we are going to increase the dimension by 3. And this data is really correlated. If you look at the channels, it depends on the kind of camera. If your camera has 3 independent CCDs, probably the data is not going to be so correlated. But you buy a regular camera, the data is going to be so correlated that we are increasing the dimensionality of a space, but we are not increasing the amount of information we are putting there.
So what do you think is the minimum resolution of the cameras in order to be able to work with these trackers?
So I can tell you about the resolution of the phase. The camera depends. But if you want to, so here what we are trying to do is a very subtle tracking. And we want to recover really subtle expressions, and that's hard. So I would say that to say a number, at least you need 100 by 100 pixels in the face. Because this is the kind of thing we are, the minimum resolution you are going to need to be able to do a reasonable job trying to recover these micro expressions is, I would say, 100 by 100, at least. And this is, I would say, if we want to recover really subtle expressions like when I do this, we need higher resolution. Yeah, usually the more resolution you have, the better. Jessica?
So action units have been around just about forever, and they were designed by a very smart guy who spent a great deal of time thinking about the problem. So I guess I have two questions. One is it possible that there's actually a better representation there that you could find from data? And the other question is, is there evidence that action units are actually fine enough resolution to get the kinds of effects you're looking for, especially in your lie detector?
That's a very good point. The reason why people, there are several reasons for why people use action unit for representing facial behavior. One and the most important is anatomically basis. It's related to the facial muscles. The second very important reason is it's complete. So it has been shown that almost any expression that the human faces across cultures can do can be represented as action unit and action unit combination. It's like, oh, because I think what Ekman did when he did all this, he went across different countries, took pictures of many different people, and that's what he claims.
And now I'm going to say, but pictures may not be good enough, right? I'm the animation person, so of course I'm going to say this, but it seems to me that the time progression on the facial expressions is really crucial, and especially in something like
So one of the things that you are pointing out, which I think is perfectly valid, is most of the action units have been defined in images and not in video. And some of these facial expression need to incorporate some dynamic information. And we actually, I didn't mention here, but this clustering method, what aims to do is actually to cluster the timing of the action units, when the action unit start and when the action unit edge. And one of the things that Jeff has done, and with one of his postdocs, he has showed that exactly your point, that to capture many subtle microexpressions, we need dynamic information. And there is some paper published by Jeff Combe and Lala that shows exactly your point. That, and I believe so. I believe that we need dynamic information to be able to recover really these subtle microexpressions. But yeah, very good points. Very good points.
Great. Well, let's thank Fernando again.
Enough of component analysis for a Friday night.
Very good, Dr.
Did you understand anything?
Well, it's the third time I see. Oh, yeah.
A whole run from the top, but you know that he wants to get a couple of shots of this stuff, you know, the tools. But that's basically what it's going to look like. Just had this working right, and now it won't.
That's the way it always is. My camera makes things stop working. I swear.
Well, it's just for some reason it's tight on here, and I can't figure out why it would be. Something's gonna be easy now. I'm just gonna remove this cover. So. Should try and